I think the work ethic is a single biggest component of that time. And of course, the great thing is, you see, when you work for yourself, 8 hours is of no relevance at all. The good thing about the common 8 hour working is that you get more free time before the first part of the 8 hours and plenty of free time at the end. So to put in a 12 or 14, 16 hour day wasn't uncommon. If nothing else, you don't need talent or any special skills. You just work harder. More likelihood is you'll cover more ground. Ipso facto, you'll be ahead of the pack.
Sir Kenneth Grange's detail-obsessed take on design has seen him hone everything from cameras to cars and desk lamps to passenger trains. Now in his late 80s, the British industrial designer's love of his industry and optimism for the application of design remains undimmed, even after 6 decades of doing it. And I'm pleased to say that Sir Kenneth Grange joins me today for the big interview. So I'd like to start, if I may, at the beginning. You were born in London in 1929, and you described your childhood using the words typical, working class, and filled with cream and brown interiors and tasseled furniture. I wonder, in this kind of this beautiful evocative image, if there was a young man with an inkling that he was going to go into design, and if so, when that first inkling came.
That's a very, very good question. I think the answer is no. The remarks I made later about the recollection of the interior was not a recollection of that particular time, because I honestly don't remember. Not hard up, but very modest beginnings in a very tremendously cosmopolitan part of town. When my sister was born, I was born in Whitechapel Hospital, and when her term came, I was left in charge of the neighbours. My father was working, and in those days, holidays for birth was unthinkable. And so he went to work, and Mum went off to the hospital, and I was left with the neighbours. 100% Orthodox Jewish family, and I think that was perhaps the great majority in the street. And they were absolutely wonderful, but that was a little taste of such a different community, different circumstances, extremely kind. And that was probably, if I have any recollection at all of those years, I think it would be that it was a happy society.
So in Willesden, in a working class background, I believe your mother worked particularly hard, as well as your father, and she was something of an influence on you, her work ethic. Could you tell us a little bit about her line of work and your kind of recollection?
I've always thought that, so that I have a pretty powerful work ethic. Today, if I think I have an empty day ahead of me, I feel a bit of a fraud. Consequences, you make work, but that's not a bad thing to do either. That was not so surprising. Everybody did work for a living, so life went on. I think what's particularly interesting in reflection is that my mother was born in 1900, so come the First World War, coming from a very modest family in the country. And in those days, I think a young woman of her age would have had very few opportunities. Likely go into service, that's work for other people, another family, or perhaps go into retail, or simply stay at home and look after the rest of the kids. But the government of the day, obviously getting quickly empty of man labour, set about employing as many women as they could. And she went into armaments making in London. And came out of the country, and no connection with that at all. But it was the beginning of a good life for her. She enjoyed it. And I do think that I inherit some of that enthusiasm about manufacture, about machines.
There's something about the act of creating something, and you know, your career, as it went on to be, spans industrial design in the UK in many ways, and the commercialization of that process. Was this something at the time, you know, your mother also worked, I believe, in a spring factory, if my research is correct.
Yes.
So, you know, was there this idea that making something was the way to, you know, make your own career in a way?
Well, it was an honourable pursuit. I never aspired, and I was still too young for any serious conversations to have taken place about what my future would be. You know, happy to be allowed a lot of freedom. But I do think her upbringing, as it were, in heavy, serious industry, manufacturing, armaments industry, must have been an influence. And of course, the pattern's quite interesting, that having got through the First World War, naturally, because that was, in fact, what most women did, you went back to looking after family. And so that was the case at home. And then come the Second World War, again, it was seemed to us, on reflection, seems to me, that it was natural for her then to go out to work again. And she got a job in a little spring factory. She retired a few times. She actually stopped work when she was 80-something. And it was a modest enough job, and she was obviously still skilled with the hands and so on, and she'd trot off to work every day. On one of her many retirements, they asked her what she'd like by way of a little gift. She said she'd like a spring. And, of course, the springs that they made were a huge variety, from tiny, like, you know, centimetre long, to giant springs that held tanks together, you know, armaments. And so they gave her a spring. And in our house, whereas most families would have perhaps a standard lamp at the side of the fireplace, we had a giant spring. And it was her most proud possession. And so I guess that's just subliminally, you're bound to be influenced by that sort of bit of the circumstances of your home.
Absolutely. I mean, coming home and not seeing a watch or a trophy from work, seeing the spring that your mother obviously felt connected her to this career of working hard. I wonder, Kenneth, you've gone on to influence lots of aspects of people's life with your designs, but were you a bright student? Did you work with your hands more, or did you work with your mind and with your creativity?
It was in the nature of my father's work that we moved around as he got promoted. And the other thing that still surprises people today is that age 14, I left that school and went to art college. At age 14, the first 2 years of the art college time were in a mixture of art and general education. And then the next 2 years were specifically art. And that was a simple choice, too. It was either fine art or commercial art. Quite simple.
During national service, you went on to be an illustrator, I believe. So was it the arts as well as the engineering side that you went on to kind of pad out in your work that first drew you to committing your ideas to paper, to thinking, I suppose, about form?
Yeah, I think you've spotted it. That is clearly on reflection, the happy accident to me mixture. I'd landed a job in a publications unit in the army, and the purpose was to draw equipment for instruction manuals. And there's quite a lot of detailed skill.
Not a lot of room for creativity there, I'd say.
No. Quite the opposite in a way. But you had to be extremely sure what you were drawing. It was the craftsmanship of draftsmanship. Clearly, some pleasure in dissembling and reassembling minor mechanisms. And I think that was also very formative, also physically very formative. That's another side that I've perhaps laboured. But when I eventually started working for myself, my first slice of my career was as an exhibition designer. I used to earn very good money, but a very rigorous life. And you often had to work all through the night. And I think had I not been physically developed by the army, I think that I wouldn't have been as well equipped just physically to carry on. So there's a strange mixture of components that I gathered up on the way.
Without going with forensic detail through your life chronologically, I'd like you to just...
Yes, we need a day.
Yeah. I'd like to just ask you to maybe just some of the key decisions in your career that came about, and we'll move on perhaps to the products that this created. But in the 50s, you worked in an architecture office. You know, in the 70s, you helped found Pentagram. What are the kind of main tides of your career and the main kind of broad brushstrokes that you think helped you become the product designer that you could look back on today and say, you know, that was a fabulous career?
I think without any doubt at all, it was the happy accident and the ongoing tremendous good fortune of being introduced to architecture. I absolutely knew nothing about that territory at all, but I got a little job in an architect office. That brought up the remarks about the cream and the red plush and so on, because not only my home, our home was got a bit more prosperous, we were better off in those years, but it was absolutely a classically, and probably still today, an awful lot of homes are cast in that comfortable mould, and therefore the choice is likely to be cream and likely to be brown and likely to be red, all these nice warm homely mixtures, and cheerful wallpaper. My mother used to know all the daffodils on the wallpaper. And so a set of, I think, sort of classically, not middle class, not class thing at all, sort of classically comfortable, homely romantic, I think, is the description I'd give to. But that lot was only the background I came from. I was then introduced to architecture, where walls were white, doors were coloured, people were remarkably different. That was the really big influence in my life.
How amazing, how fascinating. We're going to just list a couple of your iconic designs. You'll probably shrug as you hear them referenced so often, but if we think about the Venner coin-operated parking meter, if we think about food mixers for Kenwood and the like, cameras for Kodak, trains, London taxis, lamps, the lot. You've showed no signs of slowing down in your career either. But I have a question for you. Are these the product of inspiration, of moments of lightning strikes, or are they actually the product of perspiration, as I've seen you quoted elsewhere of saying, of putting in the long hours to solve the problems? How do you account for the number of successes in your career?
I think the work ethic is a single biggest component of that time. And of course, the great thing is, you see, when you work for yourself, 8 hours is of no relevance at all. The good thing about the common 8-hour working is that you get more free time before the first part of the 8 hours and plenty of free time at the end. So to put in a 12 or 14, 16-hour day wasn't uncommon. If nothing else, you don't need talent or any special skills. You just work harder. More likelihood is you'll cover more ground. Ipso facto, you'll be ahead of the pack. One of the great benefits of working in these extra hours is that the telephone rings less, and you're the one that decides who you're going to contact. Call people at home at night. That doesn't worry me either. A bit unfair, but they're within my judgment rather than the office pattern judgment of an 8-hour day.
And the notion of collaboration has become a little bit fetishized, I feel, in the world. People are agreeing to collaborate with each other before they know what they're collaborating on. What you're talking about a little bit is stick-to-itiveness, is of personal grit and a singular determination to do something. Do you work well with other people, or do you need time alone to concentrate?
No, I enjoy company immensely. I've had great good fortune employing all sorts of people at all sorts of levels of talent and individual enthusiasms and skill. But, you know, the collective endeavour is a great welding time. Collaboration, either as an employer or as a collaborator with a client or as a collaborator with other professionals, perhaps related, as of course is exactly what happened when we formalised this in Pentagram. You've got architects, you've got graphic designers, and you've got product designers. There was also a sort of notion that it was a one-stop shop. And commercially, you thought that was a neat trick. The extraordinary thing was, it isn't extraordinary if you examine it, but the unexpected was that we hardly ever had a customer come through the door and want all of these talents at the same time. Because that's not the nature of industry. I mean, most commerce and most industry at different times requires different skills, be it accounting or be it architecture or whatever. You have there one or two cases where you have such a good personal relationship with the commissioning agent, the client, that they enjoy coming to you. And that's an absolute truth. You know, there's no doubt about it. A lot of the advertising people have benefited immensely from having attractive societies that they'd built and everyday normal to them. But a guy, no matter how wealthy and how powerful, or a woman coming from commerce, would be coming from a much more organised, a sort of more, in a way, constricted circumstances physically, and their day out was to have an absolute day of a feast day.
So to feast with the advertising agency. And so Pentagram, you co-founded in 1972, and as an industrial designer, I suppose one way of thinking about your work is as a problem solver. Is it sometimes hard when a client comes in with a particular idea about something and you say, well, actually, it doesn't work like that? And they say, oh, it needs these stripes, it needs this finials on the top, it needs this finishing, it needs to be this colour. And you say, well, no, it doesn't. How do you manage those kind of situations? Do you always have the end user in mind? Are you a great observer of commercial kind of relationships? Or do you sometimes insist that a product would be better in a certain way?
These very perceptive questions, I have to say. That's the success or failure, in my view, of the best sort of relationship between a contributor, designer in this case, or another one who's not part and parcel of the facilities inside the firm. But the designer has the liberty to choose themselves which part of this process they think is of which importance. And I've always believed, and pretty much successfully argued, that if you start with the consumer and learn more and more about the actual circumstances in which the whatever it is going to be used, then you've got some pretty good foundations to fall back upon when it becomes a matter of taste. On the way through, there'll be different arguments about the colour and this, that and the other. But ultimately, it has to stand up to being better than the commonplace, simply because you've just inexorably focused upon the consumer's part in it.
But I wonder what it means to you to have so many products out there in the world that you have participated in, created, brought to fruition. You know, when you see a train pull up and you think, oh, I know the dimensions of this one very well, or you jump in a London taxi, or you pay for parking in a meter, do you get a warm, fuzzy feeling, or do you think, damn, that was the wrong finish?
Well, you feel warmer the less it's been messed around on the way. Think about the structure of commerce and decision-making and the hierarchy and the rising up through the ranks. It's highly likely that if we were to design that decanter today, within 10 years, the decision-making in the firm that originally commissioned that decanter will have gone through its own alterations. People will retire, get moved, get promoted, and with each of those changes at their end comes the prospect and sometimes the demand to update it, to alter it. And a lot of that's much more to do with their structural changes than either the commercial need. Of course, the arguments can build up and you can make statistics prove what you like. But there is this element of the relationship. And of course, the closer you get within the firm, the more you can observe that and anticipate it even, and make allies with the chap who's coming up through the ranks and going to be the man who'll want a decision later on about the same thing. And of the few products you mentioned, the one that's least been altered over the years has been the train. The train that we still see running today is pretty much unaltered for after 30 whatever years it is. That's rare.
I'd like to ask you, Kenneth, lots of people are fascinated by the creative process of problem solving that can yield these sort of designs. You're obviously reacting to a problem. You mentioned the problem of the consumer, how people use a product. But I kind of wonder, is there a place that you sit or a process that you go through every time? Do you look at a first prototype from every single angle physically, or do you imagine it in your head? Do you draw it? What are some of the ways that you prepare to be creative, to solve a problem, or to think about a product?
There's a very good chance, and the older you get, the easier it gets, there's a very good chance you'll be dissatisfied. There are not many things that I'm likely to be asked to deal with where I'll not have an opinion. And it's an opinion which will be very much focused upon enhancing, focusing upon and being very, very detailed in somehow improving it in use. And that just exercises the mind. You just can't help but cast your mind as wide as possible. And sometimes you come out with the most outlandish starting points for the decision. At the end, it won't be so obvious, but the beginning was to start where nobody else had actually chosen to set foot. It's just bloody-minded inquisitiveness, really.
So that kind of brings us rather neatly onto the idea of technology, the item of industrial design, the piece of industrial design that we spend the most time with resembles something of a small black mirror. It's the phone in our pockets, but yeah. The design of it is obviously the user interface. I'm intrigued to see what you think about the ubiquity of this product. Companies like Apple, which appear to be the pinnacle of technology and design, actually they're rather brutal moneymakers in a way, with inbuilt obsolescence and certain tricks that want to make you and enslave you as a sort of consumer.
Yeah.
What do you make of companies like this that have actually made a lot of money by being a design company and a technology company in a way that's a little bit unrecognisable for the 20th century but very common in the 21st?
I'm an immense admirer of Apple. I think in our world they've raised the bar of expectation and achievement as far as manufacturing excellence is concerned. I mean, just by insistence upon a particular style, and they've remorselessly made it possible to get the most elegant details, really beautiful details, like highest quality jewellery details coming off the production line expensive and you pay for it happily. So I think that's affected the whole of that industry. All of the other makers of similar things have raised their expectation of excellence. The downside is that it's brought a certain sort of arrogance, a certain supra-importance. And today, I believe that if I went out and bought an Apple product, there's an assumption that I'm so familiar with even that product, which I haven't yet tried, that they don't bother to print one piece of paper to put into the pack that allows me to be introduced to the thing and even become friendly disposed towards it. Now, of course, it flows from that they know their marketplace and they know that the huge majority of the buyers are so familiar, and they also like the arrogance of this sort of super knowledge, this particular detailed knowledge. But there are quite a lot of old farts about who really find it stressful, want the excellence, want all the perfection of the product, but absolutely deny the intimacy that comes with a decently printed piece of paper.
The idea of kind of the inbuilt obsolescence of these phones and this little kind of falling backwards to go forwards talks to me a little bit about the idea of novelty and the idea of newness, which is so inherent to the industrial design arena. People do need new products. People need to buy more of them. People need to sell them to make the money. I know that you're a big fan of repairing things, taking them apart and fixing them again. As an industry, when we think about industrial design, should we be thinking a bit more about repair and reuse rather than to build new?
Once you get into it, it's a bit like learning a new skill, you know, a musical instrument or knitting or something. Once you're introduced to it, it becomes a valuable part of your upgrading of your own physical talents and your own enthusiasms, and it uses time profitably. So the repairing factor, I hugely commend. I've tried unsuccessfully to get some academics to even make it a degree course. Because it's, you know, the forensic side of it, just unravelling how the thing was made, very rewarding. And if you can then start to, in my nature, you know, if I bought some head torches to give to some kids the other day, opening them to put the batteries in is just so clumsily left to an assumption that you're going to have a sharp tool, or they don't seem to care. You know, they're assembled in the factory, that's it, out it goes, and let the thing find its own resolutions.
Talking about repairing, talking about reusing, one of the biggest trends in industrial design is, you know, if not always thinking about it, certainly saying the word sustainable. You know, you go to these big trade fairs in Milan and there's an enormous marble-hewn, you know, display that'll probably go in the bin afterwards, but it's got the word sustainability etched into it. Are you optimistic that design can accommodate the finite resources that we have in the world? Because I think in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot less scrutiny and a lot less discussion of mass production of plastics, of, you know, filling our oceans with little beads of plastic. They're destroying the marine life. Today, we're a lot more au fait with it and we think more about it. Is this a good challenge for designers to take up the mantle on, and is it something you think about?
I think it is, and what you might hope is that what you've done on your way through life is actually start to transmit some of your own, their enthusiasms and their sometimes prejudice, but you might argue little bits of learning you've brought into things, and you hope that having built them into a product, they're then transmitted. So an improved instruction or improved holding of something, or simply the improved shape of it, just artistically, we say, you hope that transmits into the hearts of the user. In my most optimistic view, the skip on the street will become a very desirable place to meet people, and you'll be very happy ferreting through a skip in order to recover little bits and pieces that you have got a value on. I mean, it's scandalous, the stuff that we all throw into the skip. Believe me, I've got a back garden full of stuff that I will not let go into the skip. It ought to go because there's no room for it now because I've put new stuff into the house. But there is something honourable about finding things for yourself. That in itself is an honourable achievement. And if you can get them, as it were, for nothing, seems to me it's got all the merits going. We talked about the complexity of modern products, and my illustration would be the familiar washing machine, the clothes washing machine. Now, I did a lot of work with what they call white goods, etc. And it's like razors, you know, sort of 5 blades, 7 blades, 10 blades. Only two, I think, engineering-wise, only two will do a job. So there's examples of excess, which is just marketing. Okay, I've got that. But the washing machine, the clothes washing machine, has 20 programs. We know that only two are ever used. This is a truth. So why doesn't somebody design a mobile phone which has got your 20 or your 1,020 different programs in it, but a couple of simple buttons to bring you the only two that have produced bog-standard usage of the thing? And I think you'd be much more friendly towards the thing. I don't know anybody who's resentful of this great machine with all these programs in the corner, but they're very happy to only ever use one or two a week.
Well, we like to be flattered by the things around us and their high expectations of our choices. It strikes me that the word design has become a lot more fashionable of late. People are thinking more about it, and this could mean one of two things. This could mean that people are obsessed with making their houses look nice, and they want an angle poise lamp to do so, and they want an Eames chair, and they want Hans Wegner all over the place. Or it could mean that we're thinking a little bit more about the possibilities of design helping to cut corners and make things easier and, you know, create a better world. Will you accept any responsibility for design becoming more popular and something that people don't feel is something that happens in a factory away from them, but is something we should all perhaps be talking about a little bit more? Are you happy to be labelled as an ambassador for talking about design?
Yes, of course. I say of course because I'm old enough to remember when you had to explain what you did in great detail, often very complicated explanation of what you did for a living and so on. So the commonness with which the word design's used is in the great majority to the benefit. I don't see much merit or much ethic in somebody designing another insurance device or another trick to take money out of my bank account. But they are being designed, they're being thought through and invented. So it's crossed over into a territory of might call corruption. But by and large, it's flattering to have that epithet, to be known as a designer.
And the last question, a theme that's come up in my research and an idea that you mentioned earlier is dissatisfaction. And I just want to come back to that as a point to end on, because you seem like a very genial man. You don't seem utterly dissatisfied. But are you, can you look back on your work and can you be sympathetic to your oeuvre and say at this point that you're satisfied? Or is it important to your ethic that you remain dissatisfied because that's what drives you forward?
I think if something in your makeup thinks that you should be doing something productive the day you die, then you're inevitably going to be always dissatisfied. You look back and think, well, etc., I've made this effort and so on. But there's plenty of work still to do.
Our very special thanks to the ever-gracious Sir Kenneth Grange there. The Big Interview was produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.